abstract-driven session on new frontiers in HIV prevention science. Recent research has produced mixed results with respect to new HIV prevention technologies and interventions, and there is still widespread uncertainty about how to select and combine interventions in different social and epidemiological settings. The recent UNAIDS report reveals that for every 2 people on treatment, there are 5 people who get newly infected. There is an urgency for us to look at prevention, and within that, to look at new prevention technologies. This session looks at what is known about approaches to plan, implement, and evaluate HIV prevention programs in a range of settings. We give particular attention to innovative evaluation approaches for measuring the impact of promising HIV prevention interventions, including structural interventions and comprehensive HIV prevention programs. I am Pratik Suman, a member of the Youth Coalition for Sexual and Reproductive Rights, and also the chairperson of the World AIDS Campaign. I'm happy to co-chair this session with my colleague Kate Hankins from UNAIDS Geneva.
Thank you, Pradeep. Sorry, this is going to be a very exciting session. We are missing a speaker who was unable to get a visa on arrival in London, and what we've decided to do is to have the 4 presentations, one after the other, and then open it for broad questioning. We will be using the question card format that has been used in other sessions. So you raise your hand and you will get a card to fill out, and we will compile those and use those to stimulate the discussion in the panel. So I'll turn back over to my co-chair.
Without further delay, I will introduce our first speaker today. We are very happy to have here with us Julia Kim. She's a physician and public health specialist who has been based in South Africa for the past 10 years. She holds joint appointments with the School of Public Health, University of Witwatersrand, and the Health Policy Unit at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, UK. Her presentation is titled, Addressing Structural Determinants of HIV and Measuring Change. Without further delay, thank you, Julia.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be part of this panel, and I hope to just put some ideas on the table that we can discuss further once the session moves to the discussion phase. I want to begin by just calling to question the prevailing approaches to HIV prevention that have largely governed our prevention strategies to date. And they've really focused on that inner circle of individual behavior without really regarding what's around, the outer circle, the social and economic environment. I think this has been largely driven by our epidemiological models of risk factor epidemiology and the concept of individual risk. And as a result, a lot of our prevention interventions have been largely technological and driven by the health sector. But lately, there's been more attention drawn to structural factors and their role in HIV/AIDS prevention. Here we look at the outer environment, things like poverty and economic inequalities, gender inequalities, mobility and migration, which are prime driving forces, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. Here we're talking about overlapping and mutually reinforcing forces that impact both developed and developing countries. When we start to talk about structural factors, that opens up a discussion now to think about what would structural interventions look like. And these would work by altering the broader context in which health is produced. Here it would be really looking at socioeconomic conditions, changing cultural norms, and affecting laws and policies that really shape and govern individual behavior. Now we would start talking about targeting populations rather than individuals. We'd look at multiple levels for intervention. And it's an evolving field. Definitions and intervention research is really only beginning. In that context, I'd really like to talk about a project that I've been involved with in South Africa that has really attempted to test a structural intervention for HIV in the rural areas. And here we partnered with a microfinance organization called Small Enterprise Foundation, or SEF, who gives small group-based loans to women in the rural areas for income generation as a means of addressing that poverty side of the equation. What we brought to the table was a participatory gender and HIV training program called Sisters for Life. And it had 2 parts. The first part was a 6-month program that was quite structured based on participatory activities that women did during the loan repayment meetings, which happened every 2 weeks. Following that 6-month period, natural leaders were elected by the women in those groups to go on and devise a community action plan, which would unfold over the next 6 months. And here they would take their lone groups into the communities to address issues that were relevant to them. We evaluated this program as a cluster randomized trial between 2001 and 2004 among 8 villages in Limpopo province that were matched on size and accessibility and randomly selected to the intervention. The intervention and control women were matched by age and poverty status, and we did face-to-face interviews at baseline and 2 years after the intervention. We adjusted for baseline differences in village-level clustering in our analysis. And because this was quite a new approach to prevention, we did a concurrent platform of qualitative research. Our results were published in The Lancet, and there were a number of levels in which we looked at changes. On the first level, we looked at the indicators relating to...
Adolescents from households with high socioeconomic status of 1.5.
selection of young people in the community, hoping that it would diffuse from the loan recipients to the youth in the community. However, it took a year and a half to roll out the intervention, and that part was evaluated at 3 years' time, and we didn't see significant impacts on the community, which I think raises more questions around the time frames than so much the intervention itself. Finally, we were trying to affect multiple endpoints, and that's often difficult to predict in advance with these complex interventions, and yet you do need to fit within a CRT template as part of the rigor of the study design. I think it's interesting that there is growing recognition that we don't need to focus so much exclusively on p-values to judge impact, but rather these sorts of trials are important for gaining an unbiased measure of effect, and that when you put together the different indicators, you look at qualitative research, you look at congruency and plausibility of change among the indicators, that can also be a very persuasive argument for change. I think in order to back that up, we need to have strong theoretical frameworks that guide and measure these pathway variables that link structural interventions to the health outcomes. And this means not only focusing on measuring the proximate risk factors such as condom use or partner reduction, but measuring the relevant pathway variables, women's empowerment, negotiating power, gender-based violence. I think it's important to note that individual programs on their own are unlikely to impact on poverty or HIV on a national scale. In other words, microfinance is a foothold out of poverty, but it's not the whole ladder when you're talking about a country level. But what such programs do is demonstrate feasibility, proof of concept, and suggest pathways for affecting health outcomes. In that sense, they really can generate practical lessons for cross-sectoral partnership models for HIV prevention. And they really provide a metaphor for what might be possible by combining economic empowerment and HIV prevention on a wider scale. So in that sense, I think it's not just about scaling up intervention programs, but scaling up principles. For example, if we discover that a candle provides light, it may not be the most effective way to light a city by giving every individual a candle, but really looking at how do you electrify a city, how do you spread the effect more effectively. And so what that would mean on a country level is looking at how to integrate gender and HIV concerned into national AIDS strategic plans, looking seriously at rural economic development and how that affects women, prioritizing girls' education, really strengthening domestic violence legislation, and looking at customary laws and their impact on women's status. To me, this is an important implication of scale-up for image as the actual program rollout. This is a quote from 12 years ago, the Vancouver AIDS Conference. Despite broad recognition that underlying social conditions, including poverty and gender inequalities, affect vulnerability to HIV, there's a serious deficiency in the design and testing of interventions that engage issues at this level. And I would ask those of us who are here today whether that's really changed in the 12 years intervening. There are few structural interventions out there that have been evaluated. I've put a few out here that are interesting. Stepping Stones, RCT in South Africa, looking at gender violence. There's another one called SASA that's going on in Uganda. Interesting work that's happening with men in Latin America. There are groups that are looking at targeting microfinance to young women in Zimbabwe and Kenya. ICRW recently did a review of programs looking at women's property and inheritance rights in relation to HIV, but these are really drops in the bucket. We have not really invested in structural intervention research. I think we are pushing ahead in terms of prevention technology. I think there's been a lot of presentations in the conference around female condoms, male circumcision, the research for microbicides and so on. But again, going back to my first point, will this be enough? Technology is only as useful as people are empowered to use them. So I think in the opening plenary, we talked about prevention combinations, and I haven't seen that much around structural interventions as being a part of that prevention combination. I think they would make these prevention options realistic for individuals, and we could really generate potential synergy. Looking back, it's now been 25 years, and I think people do mention prevention burnout. I think we have witnessed the AIDS pendulum swing from a focus on prevention and investment in prevention really towards pinning our hopes on antiretroviral treatment. I think we were unfortunately sidetracked by ideological ABC debate, and there was great hopes placed in ART and prevention technologies as a magic bullet. But there is a sense, I feel, that we may be about to see the pendulum swinging back towards prevention. And if that happens, I would ask, what do we want to do with that new interest and with that energy? I think there are indications, for example, that PEPFAR is reauthorizing their focus, is shifting towards prevention and women's empowerment. There have been criticisms that it's not flexible enough, it's not integrating reproductive health, but we need to push also for interventions that would look at addressing some of these gender inequalities and broader factors. I think structural interventions go a long way towards reinvigorating HIV prevention as we look forward. And finally, my last slide is to say that I think one of the things that has really confounded us in this fight against HIV/AIDS is the fact that it is a long-wave event. It's basically a slow-motion tsunami that's been unfolding in front of our eyes. And what that means is it requires both immediate AIDS-specific technologies and long-term commitments to addressing structural factors as an essential part of HIV prevention. And I want to close with a quote from a Tibetan philosopher from the 12th century, "Make haste slowly." And I think that really raises the challenge of combining the sense of urgency with a commitment to long-term vision. And I'd like to close there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julia, for your presentation. It's indeed heartening to see that there are pioneers who are exploring the frontiers. This is encouraging and inspiring. And I hope that when this pendulum swings, and I hope it does swing, that structural interventions will be a part of this comprehensive prevention package. Ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker, presenter, is Jeff O'Malley. He is the director of the HIV/AIDS group in the United Nations Development Program Bureau for Development Policy. Jeff has 25 years of experience in public health and development, including almost 20 years of international leadership on HIV/AIDS. He has worked with the Harvard School of Public Health and the WHO. Thank you, Jeff, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thanks for the introduction, and good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Julia, for that great talk. I'm going to follow up some of the themes that Julia raised, but looking more broadly at the landscape of community involvement in HIV prevention, rather than specifically at a single experience or a randomized control trial. Let me start by summarizing the theoretical pathways that different schools have put forward to explain the relevance and the power of community involvement in health outcomes broadly, not just HIV. In brief, research has identified four major pathways from different academic disciplines. Much of what Julia, although Julia didn't talk about social capital, that language, much of what she described was a social capital approach. A second approach, which is, I think, receiving increasing attention, comes from political science, which is the impact of community involvement on claiming rights, on influencing public policy, and on enhancing accountability. And I think in the AIDS world, the most famous example of that is GIPA, the greater involvement of people with AIDS. And also from the world of harm reduction, the refrain of nothing about us without us. In health economics and planning, community involvement in planning and oversight of projects has been shown to lead to more appropriate system design and more efficient use of resources. And finally, management and system studies are increasingly influential in this field, looking at the role of community in increasing efficiency, sensitivity, and accountability through the use of community workers on the front line of healthcare delivery. WHO Europe, the World Bank, and UNDP, amongst others, have done literature reviews of the role of community involvement and empowerment on health outcomes. And I think there are five bottom lines that come through those reviews. One is that getting consent from communities or consulting with community are essential, but though that's not the same thing as participation, let alone empowerment. Second, authentic participation requires attention to power dynamics within a community. Communities are not homogenous things. Promotion of autonomy, especially of marginalized populations, promotion of sense of community, and of course, self-efficacy. Participation is important, but it's insufficient. Effective and sustainable approaches need to build community capacity for the long run. Well-designed and implemented participation will result in cheaper and more effective interventions. But finally, community participation isn't a magic bullet. Community participation and involvement works when it's combined with government leadership and the right policies, as well as informed by science and, of course, health services and technology. I'm going to briefly talk about three case studies, one from India, looking at the integration of SRH, sexual reproductive health, and HIV, A second from Ecuador and India, from the International HIV-AIDS Alliance Frontiers Prevention Project, that tried to pull together many of these strands into a single intervention package. And I'm going to close by talking about a project from outside the world of HIV that I think has some interesting content that's relevant to our work, as well as some interesting methodologies. The Convergence Project was in four states in India. It was implemented by PATH, designed by me when I was there, implemented by many colleagues as intervention managers and co-investigators. The idea was to work with four specific sets of key populations: HIV-positive women, HIV-positive men, women involved in sex work, and sexually active young people who weren't married, and to train them as researchers, to have them research with their peers, to investigate the interest, the demand for, and the possibilities for enhancing both SRH outcomes and HIV prevention outcomes by linking the two services. I think an important part of the methodology was that although it started with key population researchers working with their own population, their findings were then triangulated and tested through a process first with healthcare service providers and then healthcare policy leaders. Going through these three case studies, I'm not going to have time to talk about the methodology or the results in detail, but just to highlight a few key results of Convergence. One was that certainly from the people with HIV and from sex workers, they were very interested in linking SRH and HIV services, but they didn't want that happening at SRH or primary healthcare facilities. They wanted to see contraception, abortion, and other SRH services added to HIV services, and interestingly, they wanted to see them added to tuberculosis services as well. Young people, on the other hand, were looking for something different. It's also important that the study took place in four different states, and the possibilities and interests varied between South and West India, where the HIV sector is more developed, from North India, where the HIV sector is less developed. What are some of the lessons from this project? First, that community members are important resources as researchers themselves, and that some of the bias in community members as researchers can be addressed through triangulation with other actors. Second, programmatically, before this study in India, there was a lot of discourse about linking SRH and HIV, but it was almost all about adding HIV to family planning services and so forth, while the community members came back with really quite a different message. So you should ask people first what they want and need. It's going to lead to better programs. Let me move on to a project of the International HIV-AIDS Alliance that was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It took place in five countries: Cambodia, Ecuador, Andhra Pradesh in India, Morocco, and Madagascar. It was a five-year project. In two of those countries, India and Ecuador, there was a robust evaluation component as well. The idea was really to combine the theoretical pathways that I described in my opening and really try to have a comprehensive community intervention and to see whether it made a difference. The basic conceptual framework was that key populations, the people most affected by HIV in lower prevalence countries and most likely to make a difference, could be empowered to change their risk behavior, which would lead to a decrease in STI prevalence as well as HIV incidence. In turn, that should influence the broader site. It wasn't simply that empowerment of key populations was seen to do that by itself, but empowerment of key populations was also seen to influence the broader environment that Julia referred to, as well as improving service and commodity delivery. There were four sets of interventions in the intervention site: community empowerment, individually focused health promotion, service scale-up, and advocacy. Ecuador, there ended up being a comparison site which went through the program, which included three of those four arms and did not include the community empowerment for prevention, but did include the services. And as you can see from the baseline to the follow-up in terms of reported behavioral use, in both the baseline and the comparison sites, there was an impressive increase in condom use at last sex, both with male partners and female partners of MSM. There were also biological samples taken, and you will see, again, there was a significant impact in both. But both for condoms and for the biological markers, the addition of the community empowerment component led to stronger results. In Andhra Pradesh, the possibility of a comparison site fell away because something much more important happened, and that's the Avahan project that Ashok will be talking about later. And Andhra Pradesh turned into one big scale-up of a comprehensive approach. Nevertheless, the Alliance has baseline and endline data, and you can see that once again, this is female sex worker data, this is female sex worker biological data, and again, very dramatic results. What does this show? It shows a few things. One is it shows that even without the community empowerment, you get impressive results with the proper package of prevention services. But if you add community empowerment, you get even better results. It also showed through qualitative studies I haven't shared the importance once again of addressing capacity both at an individual and an institutional level in these processes. Now let me conclude with a description of something from the Special Program on Tropical Diseases Research and Training, which is a program co-sponsored by WHO, UNDP, and others. TDR has a long-standing program to address river blindness, which was a community-directed intervention program for ivermectin distribution in river blindness endemic areas of Africa that was tremendously effective. And the research question that TDR asked was, is it possible to make those community interventions more and more complex and still have good health outcomes and still have cost efficiency? How was this done? The core of the idea is community members collectively plan how, when, where, and by whom services are delivered, and they monitor that implementation. They're linked to district health services for commodities, for training, for oversight, and for supplies. The study design over several years took place. It was a randomized control design. It took place in a number of countries over a number of years. And in each year, as you can see from this slide, additional interventions were added to the community-directed ivermectin distribution. Two important things to say about these interventions: vitamin A supplementation, DOTS for TB, insecticide-treated bed net distribution and promotion, and home management of malaria. One is that they have differing levels of complexity, each one. And so this study allowed TDR to see whether more complex interventions were more difficult at a community level versus simpler. The other thing is that these interventions were prioritized by the communities themselves. So right from the research design, community participation was part of it. And the community-directed interventions were compared to the traditional service delivery mechanism of the same interventions in comparison districts. So 3 countries, 7 study sites, 2.3 million people. In TB, there were impressive outcomes both in the comparison sites and in the CDI districts. But when it comes to insecticide-treated bed nets, you'll see that the CDI districts did much better than the comparison districts, especially after 2 years. Similarly, for appropriate treatment of children with fever, part of the home management of malaria, CDI did significantly better than facility-based approaches. Finally, there was a costing element, and the CDI districts came out as cheaper, both at a district level and at a first-line health facility level. So what are the conclusions from that CDI study? There's some discussion about why DOTS was not better, but it's probably because there was such effective coverage already, and so there wasn't much room for improvement. Malaria treatment coverage was 2 times higher, ITN coverage 2 times higher, vitamin A coverage and ivermectin coverage significantly higher. So it is possible not only to have more impact at a community level and to save money at a community level, but you can have a complex combination of interventions, at least in a randomized trial context. How replicable that is remains to be seen. What are the key messages from these lessons? I think from past community convergence projects, we've learned the importance of community members as researchers and asking communities first. From the Alliance, we've learned about the power of adding empowerment to intervention packages and that it does make a difference. And I think we've learned 2 important things from TDR. One is the methodology. There's nothing comparable in terms of scale or rigor from the world of HIV community research that we've seen from TDR, and we really need to replicate that, as Julie just said. But the other thing is we shouldn't feel that communities are stupid and limited. We can actually pursue a fairly complex agenda, including an agenda that mixes prevention and treatment, and communities can really add value. Sorry, I'd like to just acknowledge, of course, the PIs and the research teams on all of these studies, and the references for this will be available on the UNDP website with my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for sharing your experiences on working in India as country director of PATH. That's something I didn't mention in the introduction, and also as being the founding director of the International HIV/AIDS Alliance. Thank you for mentioning about the value of community involvement, strengthening social capital, and the need to learn from experiences. At this time, I'd like to make an announcement that if anybody has questions for the panel so far, we have volunteers in the aisles, and if you could write your questions on cards, they will be sent up to the panel, and the panelists will answer them at the end. I now hand over to my co-chair, Kate.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Tom Coates, who you may have heard speak earlier in the conference. He is the professor of global AIDS research within the Division of Infectious Diseases at UCLA in California. He also leads the program in global health at UCLA. He directs the behavioral core of the National Institutes of Health-funded HIV Prevention Trials Network and is conducting policy research both domestically and internationally. Tom is going to speak to us about assessing HIV prevention approaches beyond randomized controlled trials. Tom.
So, I do randomized controlled trials for a living. And I've been asked to talk about beyond randomized controlled trials. The Caucus for Evidence-Based Prevention, which has done an extremely good job of advancing the cause of evidence-based prevention, but also advancing the cause of having us think beyond the randomized controlled trial, wrote in their brochure that they handed out today, on the one hand, HIV prevention science, like public health science more generally, privileges the randomized controlled trial as the gold standard method of obtaining scientific evidence. Then we heard from Mike Cohen this morning, if you heard his most excellent plenary session, on ART for prevention, he made the statement that randomized controlled trials are one measure of success in the field. And we know from looking at HIV prevention over time that the best evidence that behavior change is possible and that behavior change can lead to reductions in incidence and prevalence comes not from randomized controlled trials, but from observations in the field. Now, I have to tell you that there really is, and I come at this with this perspective. Sometimes it's essential, and sometimes there's nothing more satisfying than a randomized controlled trial that leads to a positive result. And I'm sure that Kate Hankins could tell you, the tireless crusader for male circumcision around the world, that we would not be advocating for male circumcision were it not for three randomized controlled trials, all of which came out with the same result. I can also tell you that we would not think of putting antivirals or asking people to take antivirals or having people insert antivirals into various orifices to try to prevent acquisition of HIV without the benefit of really understanding whether or not there really is benefit, whether it does lead to reductions in HIV infection, and that the benefits outweigh the costs or the adverse events to the individual. The first randomized controlled trial that I did in the African setting, I did with Isabel de Zoysa, who organized this session, and it was to try to answer the question, does HIV counseling and testing lead to a benefit, and do those benefits outweigh the disadvantages? Because there were case reports and case studies and examples where women who had been found to be HIV infected, especially when their partner had either not been tested or was HIV negative, experienced adverse events. And the question was, is it beneficial in terms of prevention? And this is in the pre-ART era. And did those benefits outweigh the disadvantages? We designed that study with a limited amount of money. We completed the study and came to the conclusion, which we announced at the year 2000 Durban AIDS conference, that HIV was beneficial in reducing risk behavior and that the adverse events were not greater than experienced in the general population. And when they were experienced, they were predicted by a history of violence and alcohol use in the relationship. And therefore, that might be a basis upon which to counsel women not to get tested if they feared that kind of adverse outcome. And it also was a caution that services have to be available in the community to take care of people who were brutalized by such effects. But that study has been criticized more recently, and perhaps rightly so, because we don't really know in that situation whether counseling and testing reduces HIV incidence. So here's the dilemma. And this is what happens when you get older. But one of my former fellows is now the director of the California State Office of AIDS. It was a great day for California. Now, California is experiencing a $15 billion deficit. Every department head has been told to cut budgets by 10%. She called a meeting, the director of the California State Office of AIDS, called a meeting and brought people together to say, what do I do? I can't cut treatment. So that means that these cuts are going to come out of the prevention budget. How do I choose? If we estimate that there may be about 10,000 new infections a year in California, a population of about 33 million, and maybe a million of those, or a thousand of those are happening in San Francisco, maybe 2,000 to 3,000 are happening in Los Angeles, and maybe 1,000 to 2,000 are happening in the San Diego region, and the rest are distributed throughout the state. Where do I target my programs? How do I know whether or not my targeting is working? How do I know whether or not it's effective? So here's the question. And I raise questions, and I'm going to offer a couple of solutions. So here's the question. If I have that kind of responsibility, and I have real limitations in funding, how do I decide what to spend the money on? And the answer, typically, in public health and for public health interventions has been, let's base our decisions on clinical trials that show evidence of efficacy, and then let's have good evaluations in the field so we know that what we're doing is having an impact. And it's that kind of pairing of efficacy and then effectiveness to try to determine both what to do and then whether or not it's having the desired effect. When it comes to studies of HIV prevention, we're at a particular disadvantage. And the disadvantage is this. We have no good surrogate markers. We ask people about their behavior, and we ask it in ways that we think might inspire them to tell us as much of the truth as possible. And we ask it in ways that don't bias between intervention and comparison communities. But at the end of the day, we always have that nagging doubt. Is there some bias there? And that's why the randomized controlled trial was devised. And at the end of the day, we also have the nagging doubt, even if we are getting some indication of what is actually happening, and it's hard to really know because you can't really observe it, but even if we are getting an indication of what's actually happening, is it sufficient to bring down HIV transmission? So we're also left with that nagging doubt. So what do we do? What are the solutions? And what are the objections? Well, one of the main objections, there are two main objections to the use of the randomized controlled trial, especially for social and behavioral phenomenon. And one is that forcing social and behavioral strategies into the randomized controlled trial framework distorts the phenomenon to such a degree that what you're evaluating is not what really happens in communities or what needs to happen in communities. And what we're left with is something those of you from outside the United States may not be so aware of this, but those of you in the United States are aware of this. We're left with DEBIs, what are called DEBIs, the demonstrated evidence-based interventions. And most of these are small-scale, individually randomized or small group randomized designs with behavioral endpoints that never have been proven to bring epidemic rates down. And even if scaled up, it's questionable whether they would do that. So we have a distortion of the fundamental phenomenon. But we're still left with the question then, what do we do? We look at countries like Uganda and Thailand and Senegal and Kenya and now Zimbabwe, and we're beginning to look at Zambia, and at Botswana and other countries in the region. And we say, we watch declines in prevalence, we have the indicators at the antenatal clinics. But again, the question would be raised, is that a sensitive enough indicator to know whether or not what it is that we're doing is having any impact? Now, some of you may have been at the last session, the Lancet series on HIV prevention. And one of the things that we were pushed to do in that session was to look closely at what's happening in the field. And in my case, I look closely at behavior. And we came to the conclusion that we really don't know what's going on. The system requires voluntary reporting by the countries. And in one situation, and I use this example in the talk, in one situation, looking at the percentage of sex workers injecting drug users and men having sex with men reached by HIV prevention programs, a minority of countries responded, and those who responded reported minorities of people being reached. And we don't even know what they were being reached with. So my suggestion for a way out of this dilemma is this. I have two. One is, of course, we don't want to abandon the randomized controlled trial. It has its place. It has its elegance. When conclusions come that are in a positive direction, they are certainly satisfying. The second suggestion is perhaps a little more radical, and that is, one of the problems that we have is the misalignment of prevention science with prevention needs. The real innovation that's going on is now not happening through the traditional scientific pathways, but rather through people who are scaling up and doing clever interventions in the field with lots of community participation. Now, there's lots of excitement about those interventions, but we all are aware of interventions that people are excited about that are useless in terms of providing any benefit. There's one such project in the United States called Project DARE. And it's intended to bring down drug use, and it's been proven it has no impact on drug use among adolescents. But it's really popular. And it continues to get funding. That's the dilemma we're faced with. Now, based on my looking at the data from the HIV prevention indicators, it seems to me that what we need in order to get on top of prevention, and what we need to know whether any group of programs is having any impact at the subgroup, at the vulnerable population, at the region, district, or country level, is more sensitive surveillance. Certainly it's proven useful in India, certainly it's proven useful in South Africa, certainly it's proven useful in the United States. And it seems to me that where we could be spending our scientific dollars is in more sensitive indicators of what's happening in the field, either changes in HIV prevalence over time, cross-sectionally indicated, or changes in HIV incidence, if we can get incidence indicators out of cross-sectional data. I would not advocate, as I've said, that we abandon the RCT altogether, nor would I advocate that we necessarily completely rely on self-report data because of the known biases. And we simply need to know what's happening in trends in the epidemic. So as we move beyond the randomized controlled trial, I urge us to exercise caution. Not all forms of information are equally useful, and we're going to need to make difficult decisions about where to spend program money, but for that we need good data. But I think we could, with current expenditures, even get better data if we more realistically aligned our science with programmatic needs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. There were things you were pulling from other people's talks that were interesting. I mean, the issue of accountability, I think, has been weaving through these. The issue of surveillance is one that I think we need to look a lot more closely at, and that we're not actually doing the monitoring and evaluation that we need to be able to make the difficult decisions you're saying that do need to be made when resources are constrained. I think as well I was going to say that the first two presenters had some similarities in terms of needing conceptual frameworks, theoretical frameworks from which to think about interventions and to rely on community inputs, community design, listening to what people need and what they say they want and how they would best design programs to deliver services. We'll have a number of questions when Ashok is finished, so Ashok, we'll go with you now. I just want to say about Ashok that he is, you may have heard him speak already, but I'm going to say it again. He's the director of the Avahan India AIDS Initiative for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's been at Avahan since April 2003. You'll hear about what Avahan is all about, but it demonstrates the power of business practice combined with technical know-how in public health delivery. Ashok came to the Gates Foundation with 24 years of experience in the private sector. Just prior to the foundation, he was a director in the McKinsey & Company. Ashok.
Thank you, Isabel, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am going to spend the next 10 minutes with you talking about the use of data in the scaling up of HIV prevention in the program that we called Avahan. Just a word about Avahan. Avahan means in Sanskrit a call to action, and it is the India HIV prevention program of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The goal of Avahan is to help stem the growth of HIV in India, to create a model of scaled prevention in doing that, and to disseminate that knowledge. Avahan's strategy takes it to work in 6 states with the highest risk groups vulnerable to the HIV virus. These are female and male sex workers, injection drug users, transgenders, and the clients of these risk groups. We work with some 300,000 high-risk groups, some 5 million clients of sex workers, and we have about 8,000 peer workers at the front line of our program. We have 150 NGOs delivering services in our program, and we have about 30 major grants. The other singular aspect of Avahan that Isabel mentioned very briefly here is that the team of Avahan is a mixture between about 8 people who come from a background of business, ranging from consumer products to information technology to selling watches, combined with strong technical know-how. So most of us came into the sector with absolutely no knowledge of HIV and a little knowledge of business. So the first thing that we did when we started was talk to a lot of experts. And the advice we got roughly fell into 2 categories. There was one set of expert advice which said, look, HIV prevention hasn't been fully proven out. There are a number of components that have to be tested. Do STI services really work? Does community mobilization really work? And they recommended everything from RCT to other controlled experiments to prove out these components. There were other experts who said, like, look, the components are known. The basket of services is known. But scaling up is problematic. And the reason scaling up will be particularly problematic in India is because of the size of India, the mobility of those high-risk groups, the fact that those groups are hidden from intervention, and because of the immense amount of stigma. So we set out to work. We took the approach that HIV is a known package, and we had to apply sound management principles to scale this up. And if you look at 4 indicators of the scale-up, in 6 months we were in 375 towns. We were putting out about 1 million condoms. Within a year, we'd gone to 465 towns and reached 5 million condoms. And the scale-up continued. Till today, we are working at a level of 605 towns in India, reaching almost 300,000 target groups and putting out 15 million condoms a month. So that's the scale-up of Avaman, which proceeded with a fairly rapid pace. Now, I'm not here today to talk about the scale-up, because many things go into the scale-up. That's a topic for another session. I'm going to pick on one aspect of the scale-up, which is the use of data. It's an integral part, and talk to you about that. Data is the lifeblood of a program as large as Avahan's. You depend on data for flexible mid-course correction. You need data to have that grassroots quality for your program. You need data for sustainability and ownership, and you need it for rigorous evaluation. I'm going to just take you in the next few slides, give you a little flavor of how that data use happens at the front line and at the overall evaluation of Avahan. So we use data for scale. We use data in the designing of a program for scale. In managing the program continuously for scale, we use data, and we need good data for the evaluation. Let me start with the design of for scale. The thing that astounded us the most about HIV programming that we'd looked at, in India at least, was that there was a complete absence of denominator thinking. The thinking was in terms of how many condoms did we put out or how many women came for STI treatment. But the simple question, how many condoms per sex worker are you running in your program, was tough to answer because the denominator of the number of sex workers is simply unknown. So the first thing that we did was commission very extensive mapping. And we found that sound market research techniques could be used for this. And we ended up mapping out these high-risk groups. And what the charts show are the government, the part that's covered by the government, the part that's covered by Avahan. Together, we were trying to achieve at least 80 or 90% coverage. So what that means in a district, and this is a district called Khammam in the state of Andhra Pradesh, a district of about 3 million people, is that we were starting first with about six major towns within the district and then adding on another six towns. We were going to the places that we knew that sex work and therefore HIV was concentrated. So we commissioned mapping of the risk groups in urban and peri-urban areas, starting, as I said, with the first six to eight towns. And we found that, you know, for example, if there were 3,840 sex workers in the district, more than 3,000 came from the first six towns itself. So this kind of simple 80-20 rule was actually very, very effective. Having done that mapping, the next stage was to lay out services to gather the data on where sex work happened. So we would map street by street, local area by local area, hotspot by hotspot, where the sex workers were, where the clients were, and where transactions happened. We would then take that data and then start putting names and faces to numbers, using established tools that existed in the sector. Social network mapping, for example, by the community volunteers to spread out that network of risk. So that's just a little example of how we were designing in scale right from the very outset. The next challenge was to manage for scale. So managing for scale involves several elements of a systematic management system. We designed what is called our common minimum program. So again, we'd noticed that many aspects of service delivery were not standardized. McDonald's doesn't look different from one golden arch to another. An STI service program couldn't afford to look different either. So we laid down, we were very prescriptive about how outreach needed to be done, what a clinic needed to look like. We were even prescriptive about the values that people needed to have to work in this program, values such as transparency, openness, and teamwork. We put those into a common minimum program. We then required intense field engagement, and that required everybody, including me, down to every sex worker in the program, spending days and hours regularly in field engagement, because we had noticed that many, many programs were actually not informed by field knowledge, but by knowledge that had been acquired many, many years ago in some conference somewhere, and which was no longer relevant. That led to the generation of a huge amount of monitoring data, which was feeding in back again to mid-course changes, and systematic reviews at every level. So this was the kind of loop of management that was working. So in managing for scale, it was happening in kind of in this way, that community members would come to the clinic, that would generate data. Community members were performing outreach, that would generate data. And then that data was tracked. The first level of tracking was at the individual level, then aggregated to the local community level, and then ultimately to the state level so that you could have a full picture. So at the core of this was a management information system, which was quite elaborate. Again, if I compare that with the management information systems that I've seen in complex businesses like telecommunications or banking, I would say the HIV/AIDS management information system is far more complex than anything you'll see in the world of business. And the interesting thing here is the frontline person, the person who gathers data, is usually illiterate. She's a victim of constant violence. She's living out on the very margin of life. And she is the one who develops and gathers that interesting data. How does she do that? That is, again, a topic for another discussion, but the one word is microplanning, is the heart of it. So a couple of interesting cases on how this is the case of the missing users of clinical services. The notion that if you build the field, that they will come. So we built our clinics, but we found that people weren't coming. The number of people registered, which is the top line, was far greater than the number of people who were coming for clinical services. So we looked into the data, and we found that most of the population outreach had never ever used clinical services. Most of the peer educators in our program were pushing other things. They were pushing condoms, they were pushing education, but they were not pushing attendance of the clinic. And a quick readjustment of that, simply looking at monitoring data, led to a shift in the program and better results. Another kind of case was who should be distributing the condoms. We found in a particular part of our program that the condoms were actually being distributed by the outreach workers. More than 50% of the condoms were being distributed by 130 NGO staff who'd taken it upon themselves to do this, whereas less than 50% were being distributed by 1,000 peer workers. And once again, a discussion within the community group and a shifting of that balance back to the peer workers resulted in a rapid offtake of condoms. Finally, I'll end with evaluation for scale. We have several sources of data. We have size estimates, monitoring data, quality monitoring. We have a very extensive survey of risk groups where the sample size is actually 23,000. I believe it is the largest single sample size, biological and behavioral, of high-risk group sets ever been accumulated in one place. We have general population surveys. We have cost data. And we have the government's antenatal clinic data. So this is actually a rich volume of rich mass of data that can be used for HIV programming. And so we ask ourselves some systematic evaluation questions. The first question is, what is Aavahan's scale, coverage of populations, and quality of services? And there are reliable sources of data for that. The second question we ask is then, what is Aavahan's impact on HIV in the co-bridge and general populations? And again, we have reliable data sources for all of that. And the last question we have to ask ourselves is, what is Aavahan's cost effectiveness overall and by component? The last thing that we want to do is set up a gold-plated program which can never be sustained. So we were always trying to run this program close to the cost per unit of the government program. So we've learned a few lessons from the use of data. One is not to wait for perfect data. Perfect data is never available. Use the available data to make broad decisions and keep refining that as you go along. Data collection doesn't automatically lead to data use. In fact, the best user of the data is the frontline sex worker who's collecting the data. And that's the most reliable data. So data creators should also be users. And we didn't want the system when someone catches the data and passes it on and nothing ever comes of it. And that finally, that measurement drives action. If you don't measure it, it's actually quite worthless. What is easy to measure can drive out what's hard to measure. So data is a perishable good. We finally just say, use it or lose it. We are happy so far with the progress on our program. It's way too early to claim any kind of success, except to say that we've scaled up. And we hope that if HIV prevention is a known basket of services, that scale up in the years to come should lead to positive results. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ashok. We have a number of questions to answer, but I'm going to pose the first one to you, and that would be, what percentage of a program's budget should go to monitoring and evaluation?
I'll answer this question, but I know I have my colleagues in the audience who may know the figures if I get it wrong, but I think that we're spending about $25 million or out of a... Padma, you're near the mic. Why don't you answer that? Out of a $250 million program.
Sounds like about 10%.
Is that right?
This was a question that also came to the floor before you had done your presentation, and the question was, why can't we have more money for program evaluation? And if we hearken back to what Tom was saying about the state of California, what strikes me is that we've got to build it in. For accountability, we have to build it in, and to ensure that we're getting the best bang for the buck. And a 10% figure sounds about right. Okay, I have questions for each of the panelists. I'm going to start with Julie, and I'm going to give you two that are coming from the floor. Do you believe the 55% decrease in partner violence that was seen in IMAGE was due to the effects on women directly, the women with whom you interacted, or was there some effect on men? That's the first question. And the second is, did the addition of the HIV gender education component have any effect on the effectiveness of microfinance? So did it increase repayment rates, for example?
Thank you, Kate. Two very interesting questions. We did some qualitative research to look at how the intervention may have affected rates of domestic violence, and it's interesting. Really, it happens on different levels. On the individual level with women themselves, they felt that they were speaking more about incidents of domestic violence or rape in the loan center meetings, rather than trying to bury it or hide it. And what that did was raise the acceptability of talking about it and also sharing strategies for dealing with it. And often that led to group-based interventions among the women themselves. So one example is that one woman came to her loan group. She couldn't repay her loan because her husband had taken her fridge and her business was selling food. And as the story unfolded, the reason he had taken her fridge was because he had now shacked up with a younger woman and was leaving her. Now, as the story unfolded, it turns out that this younger woman belonged to another loan group. And so this loan group came together and offered solidarity to this woman. And they said, you know, one of our mottos from this microfinance program and the training is women supporting women. And this doesn't sound like a woman supporting another woman. So as a group, they went and confronted this other loan recipient, and they settled this incident, which has to do with the business and with her well-being outside of the loan center. So that's one example of how women in the centers did it. There was a lot of community mobilization that happened. The women marched for the first time on the 16 days of activism against violence against women and mobilized not only the loan groups, but women in the surrounding villages. And when we spoke to young people in the community, they had seen these campaigns, they'd seen the loan recipients out there, and they started to approach these older women almost as relationship counselors. So what happened is what they couldn't talk to their own parents about, they would go to this woman at her business and say, I saw you at this march, and you were talking about sexual violence, this is what's happening to me. And these women became kind of aunts or counselors who would then intervene with young women and young men to talk about what was happening. In relationship to men, which was the other part of the question, we wanted to involve men and initially thought of doing a similar training that would focus on men in the community or men who are partners. But because a lot of them were migrant laborers, the women advised us they wouldn't keep coming for these trainings on their own. But if you gave us the information, we would find ways to reach men. So what happened in the community mobilization phase is women often approached traditional leaders, church leaders, school principals, the police. They set up a rape committee with the police. So they targeted effective males in the community and brought them on board as a way to reach other men. And so I think that was a kind of a creative strategy that we probably couldn't have dreamt up as research designers. The second question... It's interesting, Ryan. Seth was a little bit worried about adding this gender and HIV component to the microfinance because in the bottom line in accounting to their donors is that they need to repay their loans at a very high rate. So we monitored that very closely, and our loan repayment rates were equal to what SED normally obtains, which is incredibly high. It's 99.7% on loan repayments. What was interesting is that when we mapped it over time, the image microfinance centers seemed to actually outperform the SEF loan centers that were not getting the training. And there was some suspicion that the microfinance part may be enhanced by some of the skills that women were learning in the training, the greater sense of empowerment, the sense of solidarity with women, and that perhaps the loan officers themselves, who would often sit in on the training, were soaking up some of the messages as well. We're monitoring to see if that effect of the training on enhancing loan repayment pays out over time, but certainly we can say that it didn't have a detrimental effect on the loan repayment rates.
That you had spin-offs in terms of community solidarity that you might not have expected in the original design. Okay, question now for Jeff. There's a straightforward question on where or how can one obtain tools and curriculum on community capacity building? And another question that has to do with the fact that community involvement, it's an approach that has been promoted for a very long time, but it does take time as a process. And the donors, there's some reticence on the part of the donors to allow that amount of time. They're pushing to see results in a short amount of time. So how do you balance this? What is the most effective method to get donor buy-in for community engagement in the way you were describing it?
Thanks for both those questions. I did used to work for the AIDS Alliance, and one good place to look for tools and curriculum on community capacity building is www.aidsalliance.org, which has really very extensive toolkits, as well as links to others. The AIDS Alliance tools are very oriented towards community capacity building by NGOs, and I think that there's a dearth of tools which are really about how do you do this at scale? What can governments do to look at countless communities and what kind of policies and approaches and methods can they use to try to enhance community participation and involvement. And UNDP, where I am now, is currently scouring for examples. We found a few and we're looking for more, and we hope to be able to highlight some of the approaches governments have taken for larger scale community capacity building. What we're finding is mostly, again, from outside HIV. And I, again, just to underline the message, all of us working in HIV need to look outside because sometimes the best tools and evidence comes from outside and we shouldn't think that we have all the answers. In terms of community involvement taking time, certainly I want to commend broadly the donor community. When I started working in AIDS, the typical grant was 12 months. And at least now donors are more likely to fund for 4 or 5 years, and that helps. I think the most important thing is to gather the kind of evidence of impact of community involvement as well as of cost efficiency of community involvement. And from Ashok, from Julia, and from my presentations, I think we're starting to build that up. There is still a lot of skepticism. And I think what was very important about the Frontiers Prevention Program is really looking at whether community involvement actually adds value on top of standard interventions.
Okay, great. That's good. And I'd like to go on to Tom. We've got so many questions here, and I know that you're really wanting to see your question asked, so I'm trying to really bombard our speakers and our panelists here. Tom, this is a question about VCT, I think, thinking back to your experience with the trials that you did on voluntary counseling and testing. And the question has to do with how to encourage people to come forward for voluntary counseling and testing, especially when access to ARVs may not be available. And in the same vein, a similar question about the impact of social and traditional culture on the effectiveness of voluntary counseling and testing programs.
I think what we've learned in terms of encouraging people to come forward to HIV counseling and testing is to, I think one of the big lessons has been to normalize it. One of the very interesting experiences that has occurred has been the house-to-house testing in Uganda. And course, it has to be preceded by a great deal of community information, a great deal of community education, community buy-in. But anecdotally, what people have reported in that situation is that it's less stigmatizing if everybody's house gets approached and they get asked to be tested for HIV. It's a lot easier to say yes. So that's one model of encouraging people. But I think under the rubric of normalization, we also have a very large community randomized trial, 48 communities in Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, and in Thailand. And our approach to normalizing HIV counseling and testing has again been through community mobilization, but rather than expecting people to come into a center, taking the testing to the people where they are. And I was very interested in the presentation of results from Avahan, because we've used a similar kind. We get data monthly on who we're reaching, how we're reaching them, whether or not we're reaching our targets. We did extensive mapping of the communities. Our target is 50% of the 18 to 32 year olds receiving counseling and testing within a 2 to 3 year period, and we're on our pathway to getting there. But the data have been motivating to the staff. So they're not just sitting waiting for people to come, but they're out trying to round up business because they know they have targets to reach. And I think what motivates the staff. Now, the third strategy that I know that's been very interesting has been the use of incentives for people to come to get their test results. And studies in Tanzania have shown that you don't need much of an incentive. And what it does is give people an excuse to come get their test result. So I think rather than thinking of this as a clinic-based strategy, I think we've got to get out of that box and think of other ways that go out and bring people in and encourage people and motivate them to get tested. The issue is, and I think the Avahan presentation was brilliant, is using data to guide action. The second question had to do with social and traditional culture. You know, that's a very complicated question because, doggone it, I think we ascribe a lot more to traditional culture than maybe needs to be ascribed to it. It's too general. I would say, what traditional culture where? And in order to understand if there are cultural barriers, it has to be very specific. And there may or may not be cultural barriers. So we're working with Linda Richter and colleagues in KwaZulu-Natal in a traditional area with a tribal leadership. The tribal leadership is all in favor of counseling and testing, so we've kind of overcome the cultural barriers by having the leadership buy in and say this is a good thing and encourage the community to come and test. So I think sometimes we make more of that, and I think in the same issues have been brought up with regard to male circumcision. Well, it may matter in some places in some circumstances, but it may not matter in other places. And we may think more of that than there is. And then I guess the third point I would make, and at least in some places, is, you know, hip-hop and modernization and urbanization is much more important to young people than traditional culture. So I think we really need to investigate it more deeply before we ascribe that as a reason.
An excellent point, and certainly one that we have been facing as we look at male circumcision and we try to understand what influences acceptability, whether past history in a particular area of male circumcision that was abandoned, say 150, 200 years ago, makes a different context than one in which there is traditional circumcision happening versus one where it's just not known at all and it's a new intervention coming in. I have several questions that have to do with research design. So I'm going to start with one that has not so much with research designs but transferring research skills. And the question is, has any thought been given to capacity building of institutional local research partners, such as the universities in the countries involved, through training and transferring of research skills? This would contribute to indigenous knowledge formation. So any of you, can you speak to that?
Well, I'll start. One of the most successful programs ever funded by the U.S. government is the Fogarty International Program, the ATER program, that allowed mostly physicians but also social scientists from a variety of countries around the world to come to the United States and earn doctorates, usually in public health. And that cadre of individuals, that program is now about 15 years old, that cadre of individuals are the leaders in HIV prevention research around the world. So that's one really good example of something that really, really worked well. Another example, though, is that The Ford Foundation has supported university capacity building, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, and has tried to get HIV on the agenda. And it's been hard to get HIV on that agenda. So, and part of the reason is because the African universities have been so depleted by other resources and have so many other things to pay attention to. And so they want information technology. They want other kinds of things. So I think if we think about capacity building, we may need to think about it in a broader sense. It may be the core infrastructure of the universities themselves that need building up, and then people's interests will dictate where they go.
Or as people would say, do both. Not either or, but both at the same time. Julie?
I think that's a very interesting question, and it certainly came up for us working in Limpopo province that we were taking young people who often hadn't had a job before and training them up to be field researchers. And once they started to get some skills, they were often a bit inspired to go further with their schooling. So what we did is our South African research institution is the University of Witwatersrand School of Public Health. And we basically struck a deal with the dean of the school that if we had any interest in pursuing MPH degrees, that they would support the tuition of our staff in continuing their studies, and they agreed to that because Wits University was very interested in also reaching out to the rural areas and drawing people in. The second thing we did was we realized that we needed in our grant applications to put in a specific line item for capacity building amongst our staff, and sometimes you have to fight for that, but we felt it was quite an important imperative. And the final thing that we discovered was that because a lot of our staff's self-confidence about going further with their studies was a bit low, what we would do was kind of encourage them to start courses, and we would offer to pay the first 50% of their studies, and they enrolled in diploma courses, college courses, master's courses. And because there wasn't that much motivation to really study, we said that if you passed your courses, then we would pay the full tuition. So it was kind of, we were talking about incentives before. We felt a little bit like parents, but it seemed to work, and it gave them the extra push to really try and study while working.
Excellent. Okay, we're getting short of time, but this is a question that links up to some of what you've said, all of you, about evaluation options, either about Tom talking about moving beyond RCT, Julie talking about is it appropriate to use that kind of methodology to assess structural interventions and what other things can be done. This is a question beyond improving surveillance. Are there promising evaluation options for understanding impacts, specifically the effect of complex interventions besides randomized controlled trials? So, can you dream a little bit for us or explain a little bit for us what else, and I'm addressing Julie and I'm also addressing Tom on this, what else can be used besides the randomized controlled trials? You're the guy that had that topic, Tom, so yeah. Maybe you should...
Well, I think an area that's been underutilized is really excellent evaluation. And again, Avahan is a great example of a really excellent evaluation. Now, just parenthetically, I wrote down the figure 10%. It matters 10% of what? 10% of 250 million is more than 10% of 250,000. You know, so it matters. 10% may or may not be the right answer depending on the denominator or whatever. Yeah. So I think we have to think about it that way. So I think there is a place for really good evaluation, but then the question is, do we rely simply on process evaluation, number of condoms distributed, reported rates? And I was encouraged to see again in Avahan that they're looking at other kinds of indicators, other really disease indicators, because ultimately that's what you want to know. Are you impacting the disease? Now, again, you can't, the causal attributions become weaker, but for program implementation purposes and for complex interventions and for tailoring those interventions over time, it's really much more appropriate than doing a randomized controlled trial. There is a new field emerging called implementation science, and there's now a journal focused on implementation science. But you read that journal, and I really have concerns and fears about that area. It seems like RCTs in another
in another domain, and they get very large, very expensive, very bulky, and it doesn't really address the basic issue that we said, and that is by forcing things into that model, you distort the phenomenon you're trying to study. And I think that's the fundamental issue.
Ashok, did you want to comment on the evaluation?
Hello. Yeah, I'm obviously not an expert on surveillance and evaluation, but I never understood the RCT question in the first place. Because if you're doing a very large scale program in a territory where there's a tremendous amount of migration, I don't know how it's possible to introduce RCT, leave alone all of the ethical issues involved. Those were the ones that troubled us the most. When you're doing a program that is striving for saturated coverage, the very notion that you would leave out certain communities made it a complete no-no for us. Besides that, I think it goes back to the basic premise. Do you believe HIV prevention is a known and accepted package of services? And the real evaluation question is, how effectively did you scale up? How fast and with what quality? That's the first question.
I really just want to pick up on Ashok's comment, because as I mentioned in my presentation, again, Avahan kind of happened immediately after and on top of this AIDS Alliance work I was describing. And the AIDS Alliance lost this attempt at an RCT. But I think Ashok is quite right. I mean, he had concerns about it, as did others. And there's the ethical issue. Even the power of the Ecuador data I shared, I was speaking with Alvaro Bermejo, who's now running the Alliance, who's presenting in more detail on it tomorrow afternoon. But he feels that from qualitative studies, that in fact the effect is understated because of the amount of migration between sites. And let's not forget the impact simply of strong baseline behavioral and biological data and strong M-line biological and behavioral data.
Okay, we have a lot of questions left, but we are going to have to close the session. I'm just going to ask each speaker, they will each have 30 seconds for just a final statement that you'd like to make on our general topic, which was new frontiers in HIV prevention science. Julie.
I guess I'll conclude by reflecting on that last question. Having gone through the whole cluster randomized trial experience and survived, I think it definitely has its role. I would agree with Tom in the sense that this was really trying to get this onto the agenda, just to say that it's possible to address gender inequalities, gender-based violence, and really having that kind of rigor in the study design is kind of proof of concept that may then put this onto the policy agenda in a way that it may not have been before. Now, having said that, I don't think it means that every time someone wants to combine a poverty alleviation strategy with something that does HIV prevention and gender-based violence, we need to repeat another RCT in order to prove it. I think it is really proof of concept. In a lot of ways, it only confirms what a lot of qualitative research and a lot of observation studies have already said, that these are important factors to address. So I think it has its role, but it doesn't mean it needs to be done by everybody in every setting. And I completely agree that process evaluation is really important. I mean, we went and conducted a process evaluation to find out, how was this package received by women? Did it have any unintended effects? What are some of the lessons we can learn about combining this microfinance program with HIV? And that's also really important for program managers. So I think definitely there are some strengths to it. It's very expensive, very time intensive, and so we need to think very strategically about when it's appropriate, and then when there are positive results, really push for the policy implications and take it forward from there.
Thank you. Jeff, you have 30 seconds. Tom, 30 seconds. Ashok.
I think I'll claim 30 seconds. I think the discussion has moved from does prevention work to an assertion that prevention needs to be scaled. I think we'll find many of us now asking the third very difficult question, how exactly do you do that? So I think it's time right now to say, how do you scale prevention? There is actually only a limited set of cases. There are countries that have done it. There are programs that have done it. There are also examples from outside the world of HIV, and I mean from the world of business, which are very relevant. But I think it's time to study those and to arrive at a kind of universal framework, if you will, for scaling up HIV and even public health prevention. Thank you.
I'd like to I'd like to thank all our speakers and to thank my co-chair, Pratik Suman, from the Youth Coalition, and to thank all of you. You've been long-term survivors of what was a really interesting session. Thank you.